On behalf of the Clark Forum, I would like to welcome you to tonight's event, Tomorrow's Web. The introduction of the World Wide Web to the general public in the 1990s sparked drastic changes in the way ordinary people live their daily lives. The growth of the web since its arrival has been phenomenal. Based on comprehensive statistical information compiled by the Internet Statistics Compendium of July 2008, the total number of Internet users in the world is about 1.2 billion, Americans accounting for 18% of that number. A life without the web is inconceivable to most of us in this room, even though we sometimes overlook the extent to which our lives are intricately connected with numerous devices that keep us online. Between our computers and our ever-buzzing Blackberries, the whole world is always connected all the time. What are the implications of such a system, given the web's expansion around the globe and its increased use for diverse transactions? How should it be regulated? The World Wide Web Consortium arose in 1994 in order to address these regulatory concerns. Along the way, it has published recommendations of over 100 web standards and regulations. The long-term goals of the World Wide Web Consortium include creating a web available to everyone, having it on as many devices as possible, creating a knowledge base on it, and manifesting the trust and confidence that is needed for the web to run effectively. The overarching goal is to create a system in which the web can achieve its full potential and have long-term growth. Steve Brott is the Chief Executive Officer at the World Wide Web Consortium. He is responsible for the organization's worldwide operations, overall management of member relations, and many other duties. Prior to joining the consortium in 2002, Brott served as coordinator of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty on International Data in Vienna, Austria, where he was responsible for establishing the data center and creating standards for a data exchange between 300 worldwide sensors and 170 nations. From 1984 to 1997, he spearheaded research initiatives first at Science Applications International Corporation and then as program manager at Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Brott received his bachelor's degree from Massachusetts Institute of Technology and his doctorate from Pennsylvania State University. At this time, I would like to ask that you turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Because this event is being taped and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. Now please join me in welcoming Steve Brott.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I suppose you got all that information off the internet, right? There's no privacy anymore. It's one of the big problems with the web these days. But I'd like to thank the Clark Forum and Harry and his colleagues, Tim, for entertaining me this morning. I've had a really interesting day here talking to faculty, students, and staff, and it's been a real pleasure. Incredibly intellectually stimulating atmosphere you have here at Dickinson College, and you should be very pleased to be here. Before I start, I want to do a little survey to kind of get a sense of the room. So how many people in the room have ever heard of the World Wide Web Consortium? Raise your hand if you have. Wow. I mean, no, I meant before you came here. Before everyone's heard of it now, right? How many people remember not ever using the web? You remember a time when there was no web? It's quite a few, but a lot of the students probably have been using the web most of your life you can recollect anyhow. Just a sense of where people are coming from. How many people here are in the sciences, majoring in sciences? Right? How many people are majoring in something other than sciences? Well, then how many people are international business majors? Two in the back here. In trouble. Full disclosure, my daughter goes to school here. Tori Brott in the back. So well, that's great. How many people are registered Democrats? Huh? I get political here. You don't have to. I don't feel pressure. How many people are registered Republicans? Don't be embarrassed. It's okay. We're all here. We're all friends here on the web. Okay. Well, great. So it's great to be here. You may see that the template for my slides might be a little different than you think, because you see a couple of names up there. One being the World Wide Web Consortium, and Something else would be the World Wide Web Foundation, which I'm going to tell you more about. And this is a really recent endeavor that we're about to launch, and I'm really excited about it. So I'm looking forward to weaving that into the discussion of the web here. So we'll talk a little bit really quickly about how we got to where we are, very, very, very briefly, what the vision for the future is, and how, you know, sort of new help that we, in the form of this foundation that we're creating, to take us to that future in a safe and secure way. I'll try to stop a couple places. Well, first of all, if there are any questions of clarification, you can raise your hand, and then I suppose we'll have some time at the end to discuss things. Oh, one other question. How many people are here because you're getting extra credit? Raise your hand. Okay, so now I know who my audience is. Andrew, way back there, you got to raise. You told you were getting extra credit for that. Okay, so that's okay. You're all welcome here. I'm glad you're here. So going back to the early days, for those of you who don't remember, back in the sort of the 80s, well, first of all, the internet was invented back in 1969. It's been around for a long time. And it was used primarily the domain of initially of people in research and in the military, in government, academia then, but really it wasn't accessible to people in the rest of the real world. And back in the 80s, companies like CompuServe and AOL, America Online, and Prodigy offered a service that allowed the provision of information, whether it's business news, regular news, horoscopes, weather, travel information, through these kinds of services, through the internet. You know, you dial up from your house. Oh, you remember dial-up? Dial up from your house and you get access to these databases. It was a really good first step, but they still ultimately were proprietary solutions. They lacked interoperability, so if AOL had a contract with CNN to get the news, you couldn't get news from CNBC because there was an exclusive relationship. So you just couldn't go outside the what we call a walled garden. You're kind of stuck in the garden. It's a good first step, but it wasn't where we are today. Then back in 1989, in fact, it's March of 89, Tim Berners-Lee, who I have the pleasure of working with, sits right next door to me, invented the World Wide Web. And we're coming up to the 20th anniversary of the time when he first submitted his proposal to his bosses at CERN, which is the high-energy physics laboratory in the Swiss and French border. Trying to convince them that there's a need for sharing information amongst the huge community of high particle physicists in the world. That we needed to do something better than just sending big files around by tape or by, in those days, the internet couldn't really handle it. And he invented the web and came up with three simple things, HTML, for the standard for being able to describe what a web page looks like. A URI, or some people might call it a URL or a web address, is an address that gives a unique identifier to your web page and also tells the computer where to go find it. And then HTTP is this protocol over which all this stuff flows. And just this really simple concept, some of it drawn from previous work that had been done elsewhere, really created the heart of what we have today. And in fact, here you see a picture of the Next machine. Next was Steve Jobs actually broke off from Apple back in the 80s and created the new company called Next, and a really kind of cool machine. He had to beg to get, I think, $1,000 from his boss to be able to buy this little machine and start developing the web. And the rest is history. By the way, my talk is all on the web, or it's going to be. I don't think it's quite on there yet, but I have lots of links from my slides, too, if you want to come back later and follow some of these things to find out more, including about Tim's proposal. So the number of web pages, of course, when Tim first launched the first web server, there was one page or put up a couple. One of the first pages he put up, in fact, was the CERN phone book. And this is one of the things that convinced his bosses this was worth investing in, because the boss was just amazed that, oh, my gosh, you mean I can get to the phone book of CERN, even though it's not on my own computer, it's on someone else's computer, and I can click on things and follow information about where to find the person or what the person's phone number is. So one of the first ones, you know, by maybe in 1990, there were a few more than that, but they were mostly Tim's. Google was launched in 1989. They recently published a survey of their index number of web pages. This is, of course, the web pages that are kind of publicly available, but on the order of 26 million 10 years ago. And now we have about 1 trillion web pages in the world. 1 trillion. So what, there's 6.5 million people in the world? Is that right? The right number? So we have a lot of web pages. And what's interesting now is this is about the same number of web pages as there are neurons in the brain. So you've got a really complex system out there of random stuff happening all over the place, which happens in my brain quite often. And by the way, last time I counted, I had a lot fewer than a trillion neurons in my brain. I think I had that many at one point in my life, but they're slowly going. We'll come back to the implications of this huge system that we've created out there called the web. So Laura gave some good statistics about the number of people using the internet in the world, and almost by definition, most of these people using the internet are using the web, not 100%. But we are up to a little about 22% of the world's population is using the web. Here you see the statistics by region of the world, Africa down to Oceania, that the total population, internet users, the latest data and compared to the year 2000. You also see the growth rates over here too. So the fastest growth between 2000 and 2008 are in areas like Africa and Middle East. We're seeing really an explosion, at least percentage-wise, in the usage of the internet. Yet the percentage of the population, for instance, in Africa that are using it is still quite small. Also looking at languages as well, you had English at the top, Chinese rapidly catching up. English is still growing. The English usage on the web is growing at about 200% over an 8-year period, but Chinese is growing at almost, you know, closer to 800%. And languages like Arabic growing even faster, though again, starting from a smaller number. So just kind of interesting to see what the distribution of users are, get some idea of trends. Clearly Chinese is going to be the dominant language on the internet in not too many more years. Well, that's kind of interesting. So I really appreciate the fact that at Dickinson College you're really getting focused yourself, and probably you came here in the first place because of the international, the understanding that we live in this international community and we all need to be able to communicate with each other. Now another thing, let me go back one more time. So 20% of the world, about 1.4 million now, a little bit higher than the number Laura mentioned, is probably a little bit more recent statistics, but you know, growing 300% over eight-year period. This shows the number of servers, and another way to look at this is really the number of websites. So these are valid websites that have real valid information on them. Starting back from the 1990, when there was one website that belonged to Tim Berners-Lee in Switzerland, through now, these statistics only go up to 2006, so there are over 100 million in 2006. There's probably closer to 120, 130 million now. And you see a couple of some features here, like during the dot-com bust, we saw a little bit of a decrease for the first time in the number of websites out there. And we see a more of an acceleration starting in 95, certainly due to, in fact, the fact that we are all becoming more being creators of websites. Now, we're not just looking at websites. We're creating our own. We're writing blogs. We've got wikis. We're doing all these kinds of things. We'll talk about the personalization of the web over time. But a little bit of looking at the ratios of numbers of users to numbers of servers. So in 1996, there were about 150 users for every website. In 2006, it was now down to 10 to 1. So you see a really rapid increase in the ratio people who are looking at the web to people who are actually publishing on it, if you want to look at it that way. So the vision for the future of the web can be broken down into four parts. And starting from a web of linked documents, which is really what the web is that we all know and love, and it's been around for many years, one of the powers of the web is that, first of all, it's universal. It can work anywhere. It works across operating systems, across national boundaries. But it's still basically a web of linked documents, whereas I have something highlighted in one document. I know if I click on it, I'm going to go to some part of another document. That's served us pretty well for a long time, but we see it going in some other directions, away from a web of just linked documents. Oh, my gosh, the formatting came out funny on that one. To one web of creators and consumers, so the Web 2.0 phenomenon, getting more people publishing on the web. A web of linked data and services. So it's not just web pages on there, but it's better defined data. The semantics are the meaning of the web of the data there are understood. And more machine processable. So it's not just people exchanging data, it's also about computers and programs exchanging data. A web on everything. So not just a web on your computers, but on your on phones, on planes, on printers and other things. And then a web for everyone. That even though we're making great progress in providing web access to people, if only 20% of the world's population has access to what's arguably the most powerful communication mechanism in the world, that's not good enough. We need to do better. So to enable this vision, and when I mentioned one web, what I mean by one web is that the web is not just the browsers and not just the computer, but it's about the information. It's about the content of the information and the people who are accessing it. So one web providing the same information and the same services, regardless of who the users are, regardless of where they are in the world, regardless of what kind of bandwidth they have and what kind of devices they use. They should be able to get that same information albeit maybe transformed in some way to fit the circumstances they're in terms of the bandwidth or the size of the screen. But they should be able to get that one web of information, and we shouldn't be creating separate webs, as was the case back in the Prodigy, CompuServe, and AOL days. There's a real incentive to keeping this community together. So one of the things we're doing recently, we just announced on 14th of September that we're going to be launching a new World Wide Web Foundation that's going to focus on more than just the web standards that the W3C has been involved with for 14 years, but on a number of other aspects, which I want to describe briefly today. Because I'm really excited about this initiative. In fact, I'll be resigning my job at W3C and taking over as CEO of the new foundation. We got a grant of $5 million from the Knight Foundation. Here we see Alberto Ibarguen, who's the president of the Knight Foundation, and Tim Berners-Lee at a really nice event at the Newseum down in Washington, D.C., which I highly recommend you visiting if you ever get down to Washington. It just opened this year. Fantastic museum. But we're going to be doing a formal launch of this in early next year, so we're working really hard now to raise more money, put a board together, do all the things we need to do to incorporate this thing. It'll be incorporated in Switzerland and Geneva, so it has a real neutral atmosphere, and it's going to be a lot of fun. But the parts of the foundation seeks to advance one web that's free and open, so we want to kind of be stewards of the web. We don't own the web, but we want to make sure that we can do our best to make sure it keeps going in a free and open direction. We want to make sure the capabilities of the web continue to expand, but it's done in a robust manner. We don't want the web to break. Not only do we not want it to bifurcate, we don't want it to break. We also want to make sure that the web's benefits extend to all people on the planet. And we just launched a really rudimentary website, webfoundation.org. But we'll be putting a lot more up on here. We have a lot more content, but we're going to be doing a big launch in early next year, which I invite you to keep an eye out for. In terms of operations, it's Community Foundation. We're seeking to raise about $50 to $100 million. We also want to have a grassroots effort where we have people like you and our neighbors who can participate in this endeavor in some way, because we all have ownership and have a stake in the web continuing to go in the right direction. And we'll be giving out grants. We'll be raising funds and also trying to give out grants to empower other organizations, for example, to do good things, not only the W3C, but other organizations that are out there working out in the real world. And we want to make sure that the money we have, we do invest, has a multiplicative impact, which I can talk about more. But we want to make sure that for every euro we invest, we get a return on investment of 100, which is a really web-like thing to do. So the three general areas we're working on, which help to frame actually the topic today, the tomorrow's web. We believe tomorrow's web is very important. It has these components are necessary to invest in order to ensure the kinds of characteristics of the web that I described on a previous slide. Work in web science, work in web standards, and web for society. So I'll talk about these things in the rest of the talk. So web science, the goals are really to understand how the web works. And you may think we have it all figured out. I mean, I mentioned the protocols are simple, but there's a lot we don't know about how the web works. And address both technical and non-technical issues. So technical issues are the geeky things we talked about, like protocols and formats. But non-technical issues are things like network neutrality or privacy and security issues. And take the web to new levels, to do the kinds of research that could eventually be standardized, eventually be put into products, and make sure we encourage research to go on in those areas as well. So to do that, one of the things we're going to do, and Tim Berners-Lee is very excited about this, is creating a new field of study that we hope someday will result in university degree programs called web science. I'll talk about what that is in a second. Also, we'll be having conferences and journals and so on. We'll continue to encourage the funding of web research. We're not going to be competing with the National Science Foundation or the European Commission in terms of funding research, but we want to encourage governments to put a lot more money into web research and also transfer technology from research into products, into standards, ultimately. So there's a nice picture that my colleagues at the Web Science Research Institute, Tim Berners-Lee being one of the directors of that, put together, that shows web science is not just computer science. And it's not just engineering and web standards. It's kind of analogous to the field of cognitive science, which combines, in cognitive science case, includes people who are studying the brain. You might get computer scientists, sociologists, biologists, chemists working together. In the area of web science, we need to pull together people from the sort of the computer areas like computer science, web engineering, and artificial intelligence, but also people from the mathematics and psychology side, biology, sociology, ecology, media understanding, sociocultural things, politics, law. That we need to want to try to find some kind of synergy between people who are in these fields who can think about all the aspects, the cause and effect, and so on, of things that happen in and around the web. So some of the sample questions we might want to look at, well, how has and will the web evolve? Do we really understand that? How has it and will it work in the future? Do we understand that? How could it break? What are the possible fail points here? What can we do to avoid those? What are the real opportunities for providing not only better web services, but also better services to people? And what are the barriers that are keeping us from getting there? How about privacy and transparency? Scott McNeely, the former president of Sun, said, privacy, get over it. Nothing's private. We talked about this at dinner tonight. Your MySpace page, the classic examples of the admissions department finding you with a bottle of Yingling or something in your hand or whatever it is. What are we going to do? What rights do you have over maintaining your privacy? And what rights do you have over ownership of your data? I want my data back. I want to control my personal data. How do we make sure that happens so you can decide what goes on, at least to some level of propriety? Security, phishing, annoyances. These are things that are making the web unpleasant to use. The things that make email unpleasant. What can we do about those kind of things? And I think one of the most interesting questions is what level of trust can be placed on what's on the web? How do we know what we see? Is it authoritative? What's it based on? You know, how can we make it easier for people to understand that this is something I trust and this is something I don't? There's a whole talk, you probably have discussions in your classes on things like this about the old days when there was publishing, the hard copy publishing, there was a cost to doing that that sort of motivated a different level of research and a different level of trust and care in hiring the people who were writing the news for you and so on. It doesn't mean it was always all good, but there's something there. Now we have this wonderful situation where everybody can be a reporter. But how do we know what to trust? So I think that's a cool area of research, and people are working in those areas. But by pulling all these kinds of disciplines together, how can we make faster progress on answering all these questions? You know, cause and effect is when I was at MIT in my department, I think it was the only Nobel Prize winner ever to come out of the Earth, Atmospheric, and Planetary Science Department at MIT. Herb Lorenz talked about, he studied chaos theory. And one of the interesting questions was, well, if a butterfly flaps its wings in Brazil, could it cause a tornado in Texas? Because of just the chaotic effects of small perturbations in the atmospheric change to places even distant in the world. You can ask the same questions about the web effect. I mean, Facebook communities are classic examples of finding out secrets about friends. There was a recent study, too, where there was published based on open Facebook data about sexual orientation of people, just based not on what they stated about themselves, but on who their friends were. So actually, you know, there's a lot of issues there regarding privacy and propriety. The blog on Steve Jobs' death caused Apple stock to drop. The guy who wrote this had no authority whatsoever. Didn't matter. It cost you know, maybe millions of dollars for some people because of that. The advent of new technologies like YouTube all of a sudden driving up traffic by 10% on the internet. Political rumors, drops in polls. There's a lot of interesting cause and effect things here that they make sense to us and we can sort of see how they happen, but it's kind of scary that these things can happen so quickly. So there's been a lot of studies about the structure of the web. This is just one by Nigel Shalbolt and Tim, just looking at links between things on the web, and you start to see that there's a various loci of concentration. These are just links between things on the web. And they call the geeky thing they call this a scale-free structure. It's not a normal distribution. In a normal distribution, you might expect there's some average number of links to or from a website, and there's some kind of fall off on either side. It's quite the opposite. There's a few nodes that have many, many links. You might guess that Google might be one of them, for example. But there's a long tail of nodes that have very little attraction, but has a pretty high volume. And so you have these authorities and you have these sort of hangers-on in the long tail, but they're all kind of important, and any one of these, leaving these little things on the tail could cause a rumor could cause a perturbation, kind of like the butterfly in Brazil, even though they're a small part of this structure. You know who this guy is? Who's this guy? That's Kevin Bacon. You know, there's that game, the 6 degrees of separation of Kevin Bacon, and somehow you can link every actor to Kevin Bacon through most six different movies. And it's a sort of small world on the web, even with a trillion websites, which is a hell of a lot more than there are actors in the world. It's about 14 links or less to get from any one site to another. That's another interesting thing that came out of the study. So a lot of cool things we learned about the web through combining various disciplines to look at it. Blogosphere is another interesting thing. Here's a picture of the blogosphere, kind of the same. This is how blogs are linked and cross-linked in each other, and you start seeing these authoritative blogs, which unfortunately I wanted to get the names of these blogs for you before I came, and I couldn't get them. I just took this from some work that Matthew Hurst did at Microsoft earlier this year. But there's something like, even last year, there were 70 million blogs out there with 120,000 new blogs a day. So these are all people who are sprouting off things that may or may not be authoritative. Could be very valuable information. How do you sort through all that? The most popular sites may get 500,000 visitors a day. It's also these kind of fakester kind of things where people are setting up fake blogs and creating fake links to other things to enhance the Google ranking of these other resources out there. Is this a revolution? Is this a good thing? But in the end, how do we trust this stuff? We don't really mind having lots of data out there to look at, as long as we can figure out how to get to the stuff that we trust by whatever criteria we want to set up. So that's a quick look at web science. It's an interesting area. I think in the next year we'll be talking. You'll hear more perhaps about some of the ideas about setting up degree programs, setting up new journals, conferences on web science, and we'll have more to say in early next year when we do our formal launch. Web standards is what you asked me to talk about. So that's the thing we've been doing for a long time at W3C for 14 years. The goals of our web standards program within the new foundation are, first of all, that there's one web and it works, that it expands and remains free and open. So we're going to be putting additional funding into developing consensus-based standards at places like W3C. We certainly want to make sure we maintain the core standards, like HTML, that everyone depends upon, but also work to ensure that new technologies all work together with the old, and that the standards are also adopted. We want to put more effort into helping people to understand these things that we're doing too, and they actually use them in the right way. Sometimes I think people don't adopt standards. It's not because they're anti-standards. Sometimes our standards are just frankly hard to understand. They're too complicated. What can we do to make it easier for people to use what we're doing, using simple tools, better documentation, more outreach to the community? So there's Tim, my colleague. He founded the W3C in 1994, starting at MIT, where I'm based now, or we're both based now. We have a really fair and effective process, which is really important. Again, it's a matter of trust. People come to work at W3C because they understand what they're getting into. They understand when they work at W3C what the process is, what the various policies are, for instance, especially related to their patents, which is really important to people. We've got a global focus. We have offices in 19 countries around the world. Our members come from about 40 different countries. We have 1,500 engineers that are working in our 60 working groups now on various standards. We have the most popular, highest Google page rank of any .org in the world. So it's a pretty interesting organization that's gone from being really revolutionary to being somewhat mainstream now. And in fact, I want to make sure we don't get complacent. We need to keep up with the times. We need to get young people involved in the standards process. And we need to be willing to change to accommodate new ways of working as time goes on. And we're certainly open to all those things. So some of the things we're working on at W3C are centered around the standardizing of things that you guys already use, the Web 2.0 technologies. People did a lot of innovative things over the last 5 years. Some of these things kind of started going off in different directions that were a little bit incompatible with each other. So we're working to try to standardize all these things to allow everyone to more people to be creators as well as consumers, and to allow kind of this fun, dynamic interaction you get in Web 2.0 sites. And so we have a whole activity called the Rich Web Clients Activity. I won't go into the details on these things, but one of the things we're doing is updating HTML. There's a new version of HTML5 coming out. And some of the key technologies for Web 2.0, like it's called Ajax. I won't go over all these details either. Widgets. These are all things now we're standardizing. They're technologies that have been out there for a while, but we're really making great progress on making sure these things are going to be more robust and work more reliably on everyone's computers and browsers. I'm really excited about this new area. We just started a video on the web initiative. And you're all saying, video? We've had video on the web for a long time. But in reality, video was a second-class citizen of the web. You had to download video players. You go to different websites. You might have 20 video players on your computer because everyone had slightly different standards for how they were doing this. So one of the things we're looking at is whether we can come up with some agreed standard for video on the web and to build video directly into web pages, into HTML. HTML5, in fact, has a video tag that would allow that to happen. But the other things I'm really excited about are being able to interact with video. So, if I'm looking at happens to be our video on the web conference we had last year, where we pulled together all the big companies, academicians who are doing research in areas. We had another group in Belgium over a really high-def video link, which was great. But to be able to click on a stop the video, click on this, and be able to know that's Dan Conley. Dan lives in Kansas City. He's here in San Jose. His expertise is in these things. Or to be able to have a link on another page, and instead of going just to the start of the video, I want to go to exactly to frame 565, or I want to go exactly to 34 seconds and 34.45 seconds into the video. So be able to link in and out of video could be quite interesting. To be able to stop a movie. Right now, even on your DVDs, you have your main movie, and then you have other features on there where the director's talking over it or other kinds of things that director's explaining things going on. What if that were all integrated? So you can just stop it, click on the actor. What's the actor's name? Who's he playing? Where was this filmed? A lot of cool stuff you could do when you start making video a first-class citizen of the web, just like text is. Very exciting. Social networking, we're going to be having a workshop on social networking, which we just announced. Again, you'll say, social networking, everybody does that. That's not new. But one of the concerns we have is that social networking is a kind of stovepiping things again. If you've got a MySpace account, it's very difficult for you to share the information, your personal information you have in your MySpace account with your Facebook account or your LinkedIn account. It would be great if we could own your information and own your personal information and make decisions about who you want to see it, regardless of what services other people are using. This is an interesting picture because it just shows the distribution of different kinds of social networking preferences in different countries. So in the U.S., MySpace is kind of king, but Facebook is catching up quickly. In places like Europe, Bebo is the most popular one, and MySpace and Facebook are down farther. Friendster, which is one of the earlier social network sites, is still big in places like Asia Pacific. So, but again, these things don't all talk to each other. And what can we do to get the community together and make it easier for people to communicate in appropriate ways, the way they decide, across boundaries, across these walled gardens? One of the ways we see of doing this is something I think is quite revolutionary. In Professor Wall's class this morning, we focused on the semantic web. Horrible name. I mean, semantic web. People don't know what the heck that is. But as you might imagine, semantic means meaning. And it's putting more meaning on the web. It's making links between data on the web that's not just a dumb link. You know, right now when the computer sees a link from one thing to another, the computer doesn't understand why these things are linked. It doesn't know what the things underlined means. It doesn't know what it's pointing to. Semantic web puts more meaning behind all this, which will allow us to actually comb through data in a whole different way with much more meaning. And one of the great projects that's going on is this Open Link Data Project, where people are taking existing databases, like DBpedia, takes Wikipedia and puts it in the semantic web formats that allows you to treat Wikipedia not just like a text search, but like a database. So you can really do some quite specific queries within DBpedia. But other people are doing the same thing with U.S. Census data, with European Census data, with word dictionary programs, with music programs. Now you can start, once you've exposed all this information on this new web of meaning, which is still part of the same web. It uses the same kinds of underlying protocols like HTTP. Now you can start doing kind of interesting queries across this whole thing in a database way. Ones that the originators of each of these databases may never have thought about. Like, for example, find me a hotel in New Jersey that is within, 20 kilometers of these three sites, that's within walking distance of the train station, and is near someplace where I can go for a run in the morning. This might take going to hotels.com, the New Jersey Transit Authority schedule, the New Jersey Department of Parks sites. If I can start doing queries across all those things in a sort of an ad hoc way to answer the questions I have, the web becomes a really different place. And I think of all the things we're doing, this has the highest probability of failing and the highest probability of being truly revolutionary. So that's why we talked about it today in Professor Wall's class, and I think it's something to keep an eye on. Just remember the semantic web, and I think something in the next couple of years is either going to happen or not. And somebody's going to come up with a killer app. Now that people are really putting all this data out there in the semantic web, someone's going to come up with some really cool applications, or they're not. And if they do, they're going to be really cool. So I think we need creative people like people in this room to start thinking about, gee, if all the data on the web were really like a database, what kinds of queries can I do? What kinds of services could I set up? Another thing is a web on every surface. You know, a web on everything was one of the themes we had. This new tabletop kind of things where you can move things around on a tabletop as if they were a tabletop, like searching or taking pictures and moving them around. Whole sides of buildings that are in using LEDs or LCDs that are these huge surfaces. But of course, phones are at the other end. The small phones are really important. We'll talk a little bit later about how I think this is critical for bringing the internet and the web to people in developing countries. Of course, in cars, really web on everything. Web on your refrigerator, on your toaster, using web technologies for the TV. I mean, it's not just I've got a hammer, I'm looking for nails. It just makes sense now. The web technologies are so rich and there's so much you can do with them. You might as well allow people who have something to say and something to give. If they use web technologies, the opportunity for that to be available to more people on more different devices just goes up, and the cost of maintaining that information at the owner's side goes down. So we're seeing a lot of effort, web on everything. Well, I don't know if we really need a web on everything. Some places where maybe a web is not appropriate, but I found two different things about webs in bathrooms now. So I think some point, I just hope they're not touch screens. That's all I can say. So, but another thing that's really important is the web works seamlessly across devices too. So we're doing a lot of work at W3C to ensure that there's standards that make it simple for things for the programs on the server side to configure the data to fit the device and to fit the situation. There's really three things we're looking at: configuring the data to fit the device, to fit the available bandwidth, and to fit user preferences. And by combining these three things, we call that the context, the delivery context is the geeky term. And by coming up with standards to do that, it makes it easier, again, for people who have content to write web pages that they know will be displayed in a sensible way on devices from the sides of buildings to tiny things on your wrist or in your hand. So we have a mobile web initiative, and here's our first prototype here. We're still trying to work out the kinks, but yeah, actually we've done a little better than that. We've already finished the first version of a mobile web best practices, which does tell people how to author websites that will work well on even on small, simple phones, such as phones that you find in developing countries. Very important. But our next generation, we're looking at more Web 2.0 applications on phones, so maybe aiming at a little bit higher level phone, knowing that even in developing countries, people are going to be there maybe with a lag time of 2 to 5 years from where people are here. Mobile search, social networking, location-based services, mobile video, these are all things that we're going to be doing in our next generation of the Mobile Web Initiative, which is going to be starting in January. I'm very excited about that new work, and our members are quite excited about that too. That's a little moment. This is a kind of interesting demo I just found. Let's see. This is from a site that serves up advertising on mobile phones, and they've got a central server. So if I went to a phone that used this service called AdMob, every time someone brings up a page that uses that has an advertisement that's provided that's sort of provided by these guys, it puts up a little box of where this person's coming from. It says what carrier they're using, so Sprint PCS, an LG phone, a Nokia 5070. And this is only displaying one out of 6,000 requests can't display all the requests that are coming up. But what's really interesting about it is just seeing how this thing jumps all over the globe. Of course, it changes as a function of time of day, and you can kind of see the rate at which the advertisements are being served. There's lots of other sites like this, too, and so you even see, like it or not, advertising is one of the things that drives the web, especially the free web. And it's kind of interesting to see that one of the things people were sort of skeptical about whether how do we serve ads on phones because there's so little real estate on a phone. You don't want to take up the whole screen with an ad. They're starting to find a sweet spot now where they're starting to really gather advertising revenue, which again will help to drive further development of mobile content services, whether it's news or weather, stock prices, which are... You probably don't want to see stock prices these days anyhow. Maybe we should forget that one. But it's kind of interesting what they're doing here. It gives you hope that things are moving in the right direction. Another thing we're really interested in is multimodal interaction. So everybody see the movie Minority Report with Tom Cruise? I love that. I love that one of the opening scenes where he's got these gloves on. He's interacting with this big screen that's the size of this room, and he's zooming in and out. This is before the iPhone, by the way. So the iPhone actually takes a lot on this at a smaller level, being able to click on things, being able to pull stuff out of databases physically. We're actually doing standards that allow this to happen. They allow you, we call it multimodal interaction, to be able to interact with your hands, with voice. And at the end of the computer side, it just interprets them all as the same kinds of commands. Whether I'm clicking with a mouse or I'm going like this with my hand, those could be interpreted the same way. This is also really, not only is it kind of cool for movies, but it's really important for people with disabilities as well, to be able to have different ways for people who have problems using their, their arms, or for people who are vision impaired, there's a lot of benefits to having the ability to do kind of cool things with other parts of your body. Say. So last thing is web for society. And one of the quotes that Tim had early on upon inventing the web was that the social value of the web is that it enables human communication, commerce, and opportunities to share knowledge and to make these benefits available to all people, whatever their hardware, software, network infrastructure, native language, culture, geographical location, or physical or mental ability. So he's always been very committed right from the start to making sure that the web has a social benefit. So in a new web foundation, one of the things we're doing is we're going to put a substantial investment in empowering other organizations to leverage the web to solve basic human problems. And in fact, you can imagine that in order to do that, we need input from web science and web standards. We need to understand what the problems are. We need to study what the problems are. We need to think about how can the web really address their issues. There's a lot of web science involved in that. And ultimately, we need to make sure that the technologies that they need get into the products and into web standards. Perhaps their needs are different than ours, right? So the goals are to understand the critical needs of people who are underserved by the web, and to leverage the web to bring benefits to everybody. And we're going to be funding studies. We're going to be funding, lowering the barriers to critical services and focusing on empowering other people to help other people, empower people using the web. So lowering, in terms of lowering the barriers, first of all, one of the barriers is the internet available, the internet itself, not even the web. Is there ability for access? Is it affordable? So even if you have access to it, can you afford it? Is it useful? Is there something, and can I just get to it and get to a gambling site? Can I get to something that solves a need that I have? Is it accessible and usable? So even if there's usable information and I can get to the website, can I get to it conveniently? Depending on my situation, on what kind of device I have, what kind of bandwidth I have, what kind of abilities or disabilities I have. Can I read? Illiteracy is a big problem in a lot of the world. So it would be great to give people a whole bunch of information on healthcare, but if it's all in a language, even their own language, they may not be able to read it. So is it safe and secure and robust? Does it have a significant impact? And then ultimately, is it a value? So ultimately, there's going to be some cost to doing this. I've got to get a big return on investment. These are the things we want to look at and try to lower these barriers so that ultimately they get a significant value in the end. So one of the things we're looking at, of course, is the ability for people with disabilities to get at the web. And it's not only the millions of people in the world who have disabilities, but there's a huge aging population. On the chart here, you probably know these facts as well, but this is the proportion of the population over 60 for both the whole world and the dark bars. The more developed regions and the middle red bars and the pink bars are less developed regions. So, of course, the proportion of people over 60 is smaller in developing countries than it is in developed countries. But in any country, it's increasing for the most part. So we're having more and more people. So whereas in the year 2000, about 20% of the, or say 10% of the world's population, 20% in developing countries are over 60, by the year 2050, that goes up by 15%. And as we get older, we hope healthcare gets better. We hope our eyes stay better longer and so on. But we're all going to become increasingly disabled. And we have a big initiative called the Web Accessibility Initiative that focuses specifically on ensuring that people who have various kinds of impairments and disabilities have access to the web. And it's an important area, too, because there's actually a lot of regulations, and this is one of the few things that's regulated. In the U.S. government, for example, government websites have to be accessible to people. These are basic services now, and you need to be able to get at things like your Social Security benefits or tax information and so on. And it's more and more becoming important for businesses as well. So it's a big area of growth right now. Another area of growth is the mobile web. So we talked a lot about that. So this is a chart that just has percentages on the side of in various things. And in the green shows the percentage of the Earth's surface that's covered by just the GSM mobile carrier service, which is the primary one in the world. AT&T and T-Mobile here provide GSM-like service. The blue area shows the percentage of people who have mobile phone service, who have mobile phones. And the orange is the percentage of the world's population who live in areas where they could have mobile phone services. They just don't have some of them just don't have a phone yet. This is old. This is from data from last year. So you have all the people on the internet, so it was at the 20% level. The people who have phones now, there's 3.5 billion people who have phones. Only 1.4 billion people on the web. So you've got 2 billion people between the number of people who have a minimum of 2 billion people between the number of people who are on the web now and on the internet and the people who have phones. If we can reach even just half of those people with providing the web on phones, we'll practically double the number of people on the web. So there's a real opportunity here. We understand that. Our members understand that. There's just some barriers we need to get over to achieve that. So we're going to be focusing a lot on that. Here's particularly in Africa. This is from the Africa report from this month's issue. This is really a goofy graphic. I have a lot of complaints about it, so I put in my own numbers here. But the color coding shows the percentage of people in countries with mobile phones. So the greenish colors are countries where 60% or more of the population has a mobile phone. So as you might expect, areas in northern Africa and southern Africa and Gabon, for some reason, have a large percentage of their population have mobile phones. And then they have these other symbols that show the total number of people, not percentages of people, who are on the internet. So I just put percentages in there as well. So even in South Africa, for example, where more than 80% of the people have phones, only 12% are on the internet. So again, you have this great gap here that we could fill if we can get more of the people who have phones on the web. Pretty cool. And I think the first priority is critical services, too. We have to give them a reason to want the web. So especially in the poorest of areas, the least developed countries, we've got to focus on things like nutrition and healthcare and first, education and simple commerce second, and basic communication. And some really wonderful stories out there. I have links on a later slide about how in areas where they have brought the web on phones in, it's been really valuable. And it's a value added over the phone itself. Of course, having the phone itself is kind of cool. But to be able to get access to information that's web-like, whether it's for instance, the latest market prices for your food. Now, say you're a poor farmer, you've got a whole ox cart full of wheat. It makes a big difference if you take that ox cart 10 kilometers to the east and get a certain price per bushel, and I can rather take it 10 kilometers to the west and get maybe 20% more per bushel. That's a big difference in that person's ability to make a living over time. So we have a group called the Mobile Web for Social Development. It just started recently. We've had a couple workshops before we started the group. And they've been collecting a lot of cool stories, like, for example, the impact of mobile phones in fishing communities in India, where it showed that when they introduced the number of phones in the area increased dramatically. And I think the government actually subsidized phones for fishermen in this particular village, in this particular area. And it really helped to decrease inefficiencies, accelerate distribution, and increase the overall profit margin of fishermen there. Now, there's very few fishermen who lost out on this because things became more fair. But overall, it was a big win for people in that area. And there's lots of other cool stories that are linked from here, which you're welcome to look at on your own. So just wrapping up, now beyond the critical services, of course, there's other things that are important in the web of society, too. Things like government and politics. And I love when these two guys hug each other. That's really, isn't that cute? War and peace, natural and unnatural disasters, energy and climate, healthcare, disease, prosperity and poverty. These are all things that are maybe separate poverty, beyond critical services, but we believe that having more people on the web, you've got more creative intellect, you've got more stuff you have to sort through too that may not be useful, but in general, we think that the next 20% of people we can get on the web is going to be a real interesting time for the world, especially since most of these people are going to be coming from parts of the world who haven't yet had a voice in the web or an access to it. So, time to wrap up. So tomorrow's web basically is not just machines, okay? And it's not just web pages and browsers. It's not just geeky technical specifications like my organization creates. Not at all. It's not just that. It's about people in the end. And what we say is that the theme of the foundation is that it's humanity connected by technology. The web is humanity connected by technology. Regardless of all the machines and things that are in there, in the end, it's got to serve people. And it's the technology and those connections that we think will make life better for everybody on the planet. So your contribution, first of all, you should learn about the web. I mean, you all use the web. Most of you said you've been using it all your lives. And you ought to learn about it. It's your future depends upon it, and you ought to be a responsible citizen of the web and keep be vigilant about things that are going on. Be concerned when things are going in the wrong direction. You might want to become a web scientist. You might want to, maybe something you guys were thinking, maybe it's a little early for you guys because the field is just burgeoning now. You've probably all chosen your majors. You might want to be a standards geek. There are quite a few people of us out there. You saw we had 1,500 engineers working in W3C alone. But also, for especially maybe at a place like Dickinson, think about as you go out in the field and out in the world and do good things, what are ways that what ways can the web help you to serve those people? It won't be the only thing they need. It won't be. It's going to be a tool to help them get the things that they need. And how can the web help? How can we help you to use the web to help people in other parts of the world? So have a look for the launch of the new World Wide Web Foundation early next year. We have a major announcement at a fairly major venue. And look for ways to participate and contribute. We'll really look forward to your help. So thank you very much. I know you're all getting ready to go off to a little fall pause or study for finals, but if you want to have some questions, I'm happy to stay in as long as you want.
I would like to hear how you think, apart from perhaps, the web studies, how places like Dickinson can really, incorporate the web into their studies in terms of how they can study the web in current programs, and in addition, how the web can help people to learn, to more effectively learn what they're learning.
Wow, good question. Well, you said apart from web studies, but certainly there's probably interesting projects you can do at Dickinson, whether they're class projects or bigger research projects that might look at some of these fundamental questions out there about the web and more subtle ones, maybe even on local levels and state levels and world levels. That's certainly something you can do. The use of the web in learning is not. I'm not an expert in that, frankly. And the thing I've been focusing on more is not so much learning for people at places like Dickinson, but just fundamentally, what do people in developing countries need? And it's really surprising how little they would need to make some big progress. I mean, a lot of them don't know the alphabet. A lot of them can't add and subtract. And if they're out there trying to do commerce, this is really important. I think there's a lot of simple things we can do. Maybe you're developing applications for people that work on simple phones that to you seem dead simple, but maybe for people in developing worlds, that'd be something really important. I'm not sure at the university level, there's probably people who focus on what we can do to use the web more effectively in university settings. Certainly some of the things in the semantic web might enable more complex analysis of data on the web over and above just simply looking at web pages and Wikipedia and places like that. So. Next. There's someone over here. Microphone.
As far as affecting standardization across the board, you've obviously got to be careful to make sure that there are no splits between the old web and then a new web.
Right.
Got a plan?
Yeah, well, the plan is to keep everybody at the table. I think that's one plan. Have people communicating and to see the value in maybe giving up some little bit of what you might want to do on your own and bifurcate things and coming to the table and trying to see if you can seek some kind of a I hate to say the word compromise in a sense, but to reach a consensus on doing things together. Where in that case, you're making an assessment that the greater good of keeping the web together is better than going off in a different direction. Now, on the other hand, you might say that might stifle innovation. We should let people go off and do whatever they want, and certainly they can do that. But at some point, you got to make a decision about whether you want to merge stuff back into the standards world. That's what you see with the Web 2.0 stuff. We didn't invent these technologies like Ajax. It was invented at Microsoft ages ago. That was taken up by people who were doing kind of cool things on the web. Well, now we're standardizing those things so they work more uniformly across the web we know. So we think there's certainly a lot of room for innovation and people going off and trying new things that may be really inconsistent with the current web of today. But at some point you have to make a decision about whether to bring that back into the fold or to just create something completely different. And people have tried. Who knows whether the web will be around for another 1 year or 10, 5, 20 years. People should continue to innovate. They find something a lot better, and they find that we're not the place to, it's something unweb-like, or that we're not the place to standardize it. They're welcome to do that. I'd be happy to see something replace the web if that's going to be better off, make the world a better place. That's fine.
Hi. I realize your organization has a lot more to do with the web than the internet itself in the general sense. But there's one issue I was curious if you had any information about, and that's address space. in the sector. We're all on IPv4 right now, mm-hmm. and that's pretty much going to run out within a year or two, even, I've heard, in some statistics. And since, you know, you're talking about putting internet on everyone's cell phones, everyone's shoelaces, everything, I feel like that's going to be a pretty major problem. I'm curious if W3C has any, like, deals with that in any direct sense.
Well, the IPv6 stuff is really coming along, and in places like China, it's critical. I was telling somebody earlier that whenever I go to China, they find out I'm based at MIT, I'll get some high-level government guy come up to me and says, do you know that MIT has more address space than all the country of China? It's in the old IPv4 world, which has to do with the domain addressing schemes, or the IP addressing schemes. So I think that's going to take care of itself. I'm not sure. I know that all the companies I know of are working towards moving to IPv6, which gives you, I guess, enough address space for every grain of sand in the world, you know, basically. So it should be sufficient. I guess we thought IPv4 was going to be sufficient, but it wasn't. So, yeah. I think no one expected even the websites. There could be a trillion websites at this point in history. That's just a fraction of all the stuff that needs IP space.
With over a trillion web pages, just trying to find information online seems like a very arduous task, especially when there's so much information, so many different varieties. What do you see happening in sense of it centralizing with distinct groups such as Google being the ones that guide us about to finding information we want, or do we see it becoming a very decentralized process where everyone comes up with their own method or mayhem?
Well, if it gives you a hint, Tim Berners-Lee's research group at MIT is called the Decentralized Information Group. So I have to say I'm a little influenced by Sir Tim. But I think it's what we believe is things like the semantic web are going to make it easier to comb through that information, to be able to customize your queries in a way that allow you to look for the data you want, linked in the way you want it, and satisfying criteria you have about who you trust, who you don't trust, what are the criteria for. You know, I trust if you and you and you say this is a good site, I trust it. Some pundit I trusts various sites. I trust that too. There's a lot of schemes out there. They're called reputation schemes. A lot of schemes out there that do this. I think that this will be able to be done more uniformly and universally if we adopt a data-based scheme like the semantic web. That it can be done now, where it's even within these reputation systems, they're kind of these. They work. One system works in eBay quite well. Another system works okay in Facebook. There's other kinds of reputation-based schemes out there. It'd be nice if we could have a more universal way to search through the obviously still growing 1 trillion plus web pages and all the information on there. I think that's a really key area of research. And if things like the semantic web take off, it's going to turn on its head the whole notion of how search works, how it's monetized. In terms of how its advertising works and so on. So it's going to be really interesting. That's why I say it's the most interesting area to watch as far as I'm concerned and has the highest probability of both success and failure. Success or failure, I guess.
I've always been perplexed and actually a little bothered by the fact that national governments do not organize or administer the web. It's administered by a complex arrangement of private companies and mm-hmm. non-profit organizations. Are you also bothered by that? And if not, why not?
We have debates about that. And it's interesting, if I had to stereotype the debate within our own staff, the European people tend to focus on, would like to see more government, you know, just the EC come in and fund the whole thing, and we shouldn't take money from industry and so on. I think the model we have, even though sometimes it appears chaotic, is better. To have the control decentralized in a sense than it is to be centrally controlled. I mean, if you fundamentally trust the government as being always working in your best interest, or even if they mean to work in your best interest, whether they'll actually succeed, or which government do you trust? I don't think the ISO is a good example. The ISO, International Standards Organization, is a sort of a government-based standards organization where it's like the United Nations. The United States has a delegation that goes to ISO and works on different topics and so on. I don't think that's the model. I think that's an old school model, and I think the way we're doing things is okay. It can also be abused, but again, at W3C, everyone has an equal say at the table. Whether you're Microsoft or you're a representative from Dickinson College, you have no more than one vote on what goes on in that working group. And I think that's worked out okay. Even for the big companies, seem to be okay with that. Big companies have some more control because they have more money to invest in, or more time to invest in the problem. And they're doing research back home that you can't do at Dickinson College, I suppose. But there's we found a decent balance for this. The one thing I want to get more, I want to even get more chaotic in a sense. I want to get more developers and designers involved. When we get more people from developing countries involved, there'll be different requirements they'll have than people who have a lot of money may have. So I think there's more chaos to come, actually. And I don't know that a UN kind of a system is... It's very un-internet-like. Let's put it that way. It's very un-web-like. Web is chaotic, and the web is not top-down architecture. It's designing the nuts and the bolts and the bricks, but not designing the building. And I think that's where we kind of I'd like to focus. And that's my personal opinion, though. I can see both sides. Any other questions? In the back? And Harry has one also.
Building off of your excitement for the semantic web and web standards for 2.0 with the social media aspect, where do you see privacy and anonymity fitting into that mix?
I think the more explicit we put data on the web and the more widely it's connected, the more important privacy research and norms and standards are going to become. So absolutely critical. And so we have in our group, even at W3C, we have a privacy activity. We have a security activity. It works alongside of the people developing new technologies. And I do think that's an area that even requires more investment, absolutely. Privacy, security, and trust, I think, are the next things we need to invest more money and time into, and more brain power, absolutely. It's scary, you know. The things you can learn off the web, especially the more you connect the data, the easier it is to learn even more interesting things. Have one in the back here.
Considering privacy, security, and trust, do you think that the web as this sort of chaotic being has, does it transcend conventional ethics? And what is the relationship between W3C and the ethical situation of the web?
So what do you mean transcend conventional ethics? An example of...
To put it in another way, would you say that you have as... You are arbiters of the technology side, of the standard side, of the technological standard side. Do you also have to arbit the ethical standard side?
We've had some. So, for example, when we sought to open an office in China, I had some people come and say, "Well, you can't do that. They don't believe in free speech." So you should just forget, if you just don't think about opening an office there. And I think you're better off engaging with people. I mean, maybe there's a limit. There's certain levels of ethics you just don't want to touch. But I think, that's because my personal political view in a sense too, it's not for us to judge necessarily what's right, and it's not necessarily our to always judge the pace at which things are going in a direction you may like. I mean, China's gone through a revolution in the last 20 years. It's a very vastly different place than it was before. Is it as free and open as we think we are here? I don't know. But they're going in a right direction, and maybe sometimes they go backwards by some measure of morality and ethics. But I think what we're better off doing is providing tools that allow people to do. That could allow people to do good things and good and evil, in a sense, right? And hope that let's leave it up to governments and leave it up to laws to determine what content's good and evil, what behaviors are good and evil. But let's provide the tools to allow you both, I guess, to do evil, but also to police it and to do good and to encourage it. That's just the personal feeling. And I think that's the way we behave at W3C. We continue to make the technologies available to anybody who wants them, and whether they're doing good or evil, we don't try to step in.
I don't mean to appear to be, and I'm not, a Luddite or anything like that. But I am a guy who spends a lot of time on the net, staring into a computer screen, and and I am familiar over the years with these studies about how TV, computers, even cell phones, the technology, in the degree to which it changes human life. Mm-hmm. Do you have any kind of a dark team at your organization that looks at the downside of really what your organization is trying to accomplish?
Yeah, we do talk about it a lot. We don't have a dark team. Maybe we should invent one. But we don't talk about it. yeah, there's downsides, absolutely. Again, I think there's more good than harm that's done by. I think whenever you provide a forum like the Clark Forum to allow people to get together and communicate, and even more powerfully than having a room, you have the whole world as your room, or the potential for the whole world to be your room. You encourage the kinds of communications that wouldn't happen otherwise with people, whether they're next door or people across the other side of the world. I think that's a good thing in general. So, but we should probably, it'd be kind of interesting to have a workshop just on the dark side of the dark web, the dark universe. Maybe that's the next Clark Forum event you can put on. Okay, good.
Right. I forget exactly who it was that said it, but it's been said a million monkeys at typewriters can write the works of Shakespeare, and thanks to the internet, we know that that's not true. And I know another source, Ben Yahtzee Croshaw, a recent internet celebrity, saying that the internet seems almost diametrically opposed to the idea of quality control.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
And with the burgeoning of Web 2.0, and everyone's a creator as well as a consumer. Do you think there's going to be an increased problem with that, with the internet, and basically like the dregs of internet culture burgeoning as well with Web 2.0?
I think the whole area of quality and trust is a really important area, actually, and it's absolutely necessary. We are just going to drown in crud, you know, and or we're going to rely on a handful of companies to decide for us what's good and what's, you know, what is everyone really searching for, or what's the, or for Wikipedia, what's the definitive answer on, even if Wikipedia is open to everybody to edit, it's still. What's the definitive answer on the subject, and how's it going to change by tomorrow when someone else changes it? So it's a whole bunch of really, really important, again, web sciencey areas that are more than just the purview of computer scientists. And we hope that somehow pulling all these people together more efficiently than has been done in the past. It's been done. We're not inventing something completely new, but trying to provide a forum where these people can get together. Hopefully we can address these issues about quality, about trust, about security and privacy. In a more effective manner.
All right, let me apologize for how obscure this question might come off. But have you ever heard of the Freenet?
Freenet?
Yeah. Basically, it's almost a separate internet where their goal is privacy above all else.
Right.
And where you go, but just be 100% anonymous when you post, and it's extremely decentralized. I was just curious if W3C knew anything about it.
We know, but it's not. But it's using all the same. It's using web technologies, though, right? It's just that the rules of participation are controlled.
Like it's complicated. I've been trying to figure this thing out for a while, and I still can't quite get a grasp. It's like everyone. It's like web servers within web servers in a weird way. Like, everyone who's on the net can have their own.
And they have all through proxies and stuff, so you can't trace back the.
No, that's Tor. That's actually something completely different. It's weird. It's, I don't know. I was just curious if you had heard of it. It's not a big deal.
Yeah, I've heard of it, but I haven't used it, frankly, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah.
Please join me in thanking our guest tonight, Steve Frost.
Thank you. Thank you. Good job.
concludes our presentation. Thank you for attending.